This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, it's Norman Swan here and you're listening to The Health Report. This is the first of an important two-part series called Facing the Evidence, made by Alex Barrett, who won a Eureka Prize for her last Health Report series. Well, this series, Alex, who's a senior public health researcher at the University of Sydney, looks at an alarming pattern of poor practice in healthcare stretching back centuries. But it's no longer the Middle Ages, so excuses are wearing thin. It's a failure to make use of effective treatments, and worse, giving treatments that do harm. Every year, the toll from these mistakes is high. In the United States, they've estimated that 1 in 2 patients fail to receive best evidence care, and 1 in 10 get care which is potentially harmful. Overall, people only receive about half the treatments they need, and they're dying as a result. It's been shown in heart disease that hospitals which follow guidelines save more lives. This series is about how to get doctors, nurses, physiotherapists, psychologists, and other health professionals to practice according to the evidence. What you'll discover is that the time for negotiation is over. We need to demand it.
There is a view by some clinicians that they are essentially above the evidence, that they shouldn't have to be changing their practice. There simply seems to be a level of resistance that I find astounding.
It's not even interesting, it's vital, because everybody becomes a patient at one time in their life. There's an awful lot of treatments that are used, but they've never actually been tested. Why are they used? Because they were taught to use them, they're what people usually use, or other sorts of bizarre reasons why these treatments are offered.
Well, there's some pretty bad things going on within clinical medicine, and the public ought to be very angry about them. With the best of intentions, I and other health professionals, and it's not just doctors, can do massive harm. It's only a matter of admitting that possibility.
That was Sir Ian Chalmers, one of the co-founders of the Cochrane Collaboration, an international not-for-profit organisation which provides up-to-date information about the effects of healthcare. Before him were two patient advocates, Karen Carey-Hazel and Hazel Thornton. More from each of them later. Every day, doctors and other health professionals use treatments that are harmful or fail to use therapies that have been proven to work. In the US, there is so much medical error that Congress has directed the Institute of Medicine to develop a strategy to improve the quality of care. In its initial report, the Institute noted perhaps as many as 100,000 Americans die every year from medical errors, including the use of inappropriate treatments. That's much more than from car accidents, breast cancer, or AIDS. Many more suffer side effects and unnecessary costs. Surely doctors and other health professionals are well-intentioned and want the best for their patients. So what's going wrong? That's what this program's about. Let's start with the voice of a man whose child-rearing advice affected generations of children.
The two questions that are most often asked about my child-rearing advice are, have my views changed very much, and if so, how? And the second is, am I responsible for all the characteristics of modern youth that irritates so many of the older generation?
Guest of honour, the American paediatrician Dr. Benjamin Spock, the author of Baby and Child Care, which has sold more than 22 million copies in 26 languages and has been described as one of the most influential books of the 20th century.
I bought a copy of Dr. Benjamin Spock's book, Baby and Child Care, and I actually marked the passage saying babies should be put to sleep on their fronts. Now, I promulgated that advice. We now know that had people looked at the evidence, by 1970 it would have been clear that this was actually lethally bad advice. And it's been estimated that in the UK, had we taken notice of the evidence, it might have prevented about 10,000 deaths from cot death. And the estimates for US, Australia and Europe is over 50,000 unnecessary deaths. That's a tragic consequence of not paying attention to the need for evidence.
Sir Ian Chalmers, one of the co-founders of the Cochrane Collaboration. Spock hasn't been alone in giving advice that turned out to be lethally bad. Doctors have always relied on the opinions of experts to guide their treatment decisions. Too often, that's all they are. Opinions based on belief and prediction rather than on solid evidence. Professor Gordon Guyatt from McMaster University in Canada is a world leader in evidence-based medicine and an advocate of the need to replace opinion with evidence. He was appalled to find out that following the advice of senior clinicians led him to give treatments that he later found out were useless and dangerous.
There was a drug that suppressed abnormal heartbeat, and you could see that when you gave the drug, the abnormal heartbeat settled down. And we had a logic that everybody who came into the hospital with a heart attack got this drug to make sure they wouldn't run into any problems with an abnormal heartbeat. Little did I know, I only found out later, that at the time I was giving out this drug because the doctors who were my bosses, the heart specialists, recommended doing so. There were randomized trials saying that for preventing these abnormal heartbeats, the drug was not effective and it had costs and side effects. The drug was just useless and had side effects, but there are a whole host of situations where people died. So another example of drugs to treat abnormal heartbeats, there was one that the heart specialists were sure would reduce arrhythmias that kill people. It was widely used. When the randomized trials came in, it actually killed people. Heart failure is a good example. There was a whole set of drugs with excellent biologic effects. They make the heart pump better. When you measure the pressures, they seem to do good things to the pressures. And a whole set of these drugs, when tested in randomized trials, turned out to be killing people.
Professor Gordon Guyatt, Professor of Medicine and Clinical Epidemiology at McMaster Medical School in Canada. It's been estimated that those antiarrhythmic drugs he was talking about killed more Americans every year than the whole Vietnam War. But treatment errors are not just a thing of the past. They're happening in Australia today. Dr. Ian Harris is an orthopaedic surgeon in Sydney who's unhappy with how treatment decisions are being made, like the surgical treatment of low back pain.
There's a procedure called intradiscal electrothermal therapy.
So this is the disc that's in between the vertebrae in your back.
Yes. And so they have this probe put into their disc, having it heated up to a certain temperature for a certain time to shrink the disc. It's a day-only procedure, but it's expensive, the equipment's very expensive, and you're looking at a few thousand dollars every time you do it. It became widely used, and then one of the surgeons in Adelaide did a study where everybody had the probe put in, but blinded to the surgeon and blinded to the patient and blinded to the outcome assessor was whether the probe was actually actively plugged in or not. So it was a very good study, and they found absolutely no difference whatsoever. I think they had about a 24 or 25% improvement in the placebo group and the active group. So there's zero evidence that this actually provides any benefit whatsoever, yet this is still being used. This is something that has been shown not to work. A lot of the other things that we do, like spine fusions and disc replacements, they haven't been put up against sham surgery, and they are being used widely.
Dr. Ian Harris, Director of Orthopaedic Surgery at Liverpool Hospital. I could go on and on, giving examples of treatments that have been shown to be useless or harmful, many of which are still in use. And just as tragically, examples of treatments which have been proven to work that people are not using. How on earth does this happen when doctors and other health professionals want to help their patients? Many argue that the problem is that doctors don't use evidence in their practice. That might sound very strange, and most doctors would probably claim that of course they use evidence. But the problem is the type of evidence they use. To clarify, let me introduce Cheryl, who has osteoarthritis of her knee.
I started playing bowls about 18 months ago and the arthritis just flared up. So I thought I wanted to get it fixed because I feel that I'm not that old. I want to play bowls and I'm a nurse, so I want to still do nursing and I want to do all the things I want to do. So
you've got this arthritis, it's interfering with your life, so you went to the doctor and the doctor said,
we can do an arthroscope and have a look at it. They would wash it out and see if there was any floating bone in there that was causing any of the pain, and also to take the arthritis off the kneecap itself.
Cheryl's description of what the doctor said is crucial. We can wash it out, see if there's any floating bone in there, and take the arthritis off the knee. Just like with the heart drugs, the rationale is again a biological one. The thinking goes like this. This patient's symptoms are a result of a biological problem, in this case with the way the knee joint works. So if we correct the biology, remove the debris that's stopping the joint from working properly, the symptoms should go away. Problem fixed. It's logical and it sounds reasonable, but often it just doesn't hold up. Worse, it's not obvious to doctors that this logic doesn't work.
There were literally hundreds of thousands of operations being done in the United States for osteoarthritis of the knee. The surgeons had an excellent rationale that they would wash out the undesirable substances from the knee, take out little pieces of debris that might be floating around in the knee, and this would help people with osteoarthritis. And when patients came back, they said, well, I do seem to be feeling better. When tested in a randomized trial, absolutely no impact of this treatment. It was compelling biologic rationale. The trouble is that what we found out is that that kind of logic, many times it works out just the way you think, but many other times it doesn't. And only now do we realize just how misleading that kind of logic can be.
Professor Gordon Guyatt, McMaster Medical School, Department of Medicine and Clinical Epidemiology and Biostatistics. The trial Guyatt mentioned is a famous one, published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2002. Its results provoked a storm of protest from American orthopaedic surgeons, who, like orthopaedic surgeons here, had been doing, and still are doing, many thousands of these operations every year. In the trial, patients were allocated randomly to receive the real surgery or sham surgery, in other words, pretend surgery, where patients had an anaesthetic and an incision to look like surgery was done, but no actual surgery on the knee. The group who had the real surgery did no better in terms of pain or function. The trial completely contradicted all expectations based on biological predictions. The treatment should have worked, but to everyone's surprise, it didn't. So if we rely on predictions based on biology to guide treatment decisions, we're going to get badly misled sometimes. But that's exactly the way doctors and other health professionals are taught to think, to reason from biological principles. Now that we know we can't rely on predictions from biology, how then do we test whether a treatment works? Sir Ian Chalmers.
For some things, stopping bleeding from an injured arm, you don't need carefully controlled tests. Tests that are designed to reduce the likelihood that you're going to be misled into thinking either that a treatment is useful when it isn't, or that a treatment is useless when in fact it's useful. If one moves away now from these treatments that have, if you like, slam-bang effects, like stopping bleeding, most things, effects aren't nearly as dramatic as that. Let's take, for example, acute traumatic brain injury. There are a lot of these now as the world becomes more motorized. And one of the treatments that is probably still too widely given, but has been widely given for more than 30 years, is steroid injections. Researchers at the London School of Hygiene set up a controlled trial where a comparison is made between patients who are given the steroids and patients who are not given the steroids. In this case, they were given a placebo drug. It was an international trial, countries from Albania to Vietnam. And after about 10,000 patients, they decided that they had to stop the trial. This treatment, which has been in use for 30 years or more, was found to be killing patients. Now, no one had picked that up. It wasn't like a bleeding thing where the effect is obvious. And it's in those circumstances that we need carefully controlled trials, trials where you compare one treatment with another treatment in ways which protect you from being misled by bias. And that will often require you to make sure that the groups start off comparable and that you don't have more ill people in one group than the other and therefore bias the comparison. You use some method of chance, like random allocation, to decide who should have which treatment. And then you observe the outcomes in ways which, again, try to reduce the chances that you'll be misled by bias.
What you just heard was a description of a randomized trial. If you really want to test whether a treatment works, you must compare two groups of real patients. To make the comparison fair, the groups must be created by randomization. These days it's done by a computer, which runs the equivalent of a lottery, allocating some patients to the new therapy and others to the comparison therapy. That might be no treatment, a placebo, or usual care. The important thing is that patients and doctors don't choose who receives which therapy. It's done just by chance. This ensures there are no differences between the groups of patients being compared, except for the therapy you want to test. Then you need to follow everyone to see how they do. Assessments of their progress should be made by observers who are blinded, In other words, who don't know which treatment each person received. We now know that studies conducted like this are much less likely to be biased. For example, the reason doctors got it wrong on hormone replacement therapy was partly because they relied on biologic rationale, that estrogen should be good for the heart and for bones, and partly because there had never been a randomized trial, so it hadn't been properly tested. Let's go back to Cheryl. So you went into hospital and then what happened?
I had day surgery, had 2 weeks off work with it to let it settle back down again, and then I found that I couldn't step up a step, or the knee couldn't take the impact of the step anymore. The pain just didn't go away. It wasn't probably as bad, but out of 100%, it was still 80% there. When I played bowls again, it hurt more than it did before. And I did give it a bit of time. I'm not saying I went out and played bowls 2 weeks later, which I didn't. And then they said that sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
And there was the first time you'd heard that maybe it wouldn't work?
Yep, yep.
Did the doctor say anything to you about a trial that shows that it doesn't work, that it doesn't help in terms of pain and function?
No, they didn't say that.
Anyone can have a bad outcome. But Cheryl's story illustrates what's more likely to happen if doctors and patients don't know about and don't use evidence from trials. You're listening to The Health Report on ABC Radio National. I'm Alex Barrett, and this is the first of two programs on evidence in healthcare. Thousands of drug trials have been done in the last decade, and as a result, we're now in a pretty good position to know what drugs work, how well they work, and what their side effects are. In fact, Australia has one of the best evidence-based systems in the world for approving and funding drugs, the PBS, the Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme. Because to get on the market, and on the PBS, randomised trials are needed, the evidence base for drugs is better than for any other part of healthcare, but there are many other sorts of therapies that are offered by health professionals. In fact, the list is enormous. Just think about it. Operations, both major and minor surgery, procedures in which devices are implanted, dental treatments, dietary advice, psychological counselling, physiotherapy, chiropractic, and on and on. We're a long way from knowing what works for most of these interventions, because most of them haven't been properly tested. Dr. Harris again.
For some fractures, there have been, within the last few years, large-scale randomised controlled trials. But for a lot of the stuff we do, there isn't really much out there. And this is a peculiar problem with surgery because in medicine, it's easy to get a placebo pill and do a trial. In surgery, nobody wants to do trials with sham surgery. And surgery has a huge placebo effect, which we're using. Anybody who puts their hands on people has a big placebo effect.
What proportion of the operations that you do each week would have evidence to support them?
Randomised trial evidence with sham surgery would be almost none. There's very little evidence of that calibre. It bothers me a lot because I see harm done. For instance, what I'm seeing from the increase in back surgeries done is an increase in revision back surgeries. And I'm seeing a lot of people who are pretty miserable who've had their backs operated on.
Why do you think that other surgeons are not concerned?
I don't think they're actively ignoring it. I think a lot of people just aren't aware of it. One of the problems with surgery is it's an apprenticeship. I was trained to do what the people I worked with did. I wasn't taught evidence-based medicine. I was just taught how to operate. And to a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Surgeons tend to operate. If you go to see a spine surgeon with back pain, odds are you'll come out of there with a spinal operation. If you go and see a chiropractor with back pain, you're not going to get out of there without a spinal manipulation. I think it's the same thing for radiation oncologists or rheumatologists. People just do what they do because they think that it's the best.
Dr. Ian Harris. So even when there is good quality evidence available, most doctors aren't using that evidence in their practice. More on that later, because first, there's also a problem with the type of research that's being done. A huge proportion of spending on medical research in this country, and in the UK, the USA and Canada, is on what's called basic or biomedical research, lab-based research with test tubes, for example. That's research asking fundamental questions about biology in the hope that one day it will lead to important cures. But the track record of biomedical research in translating through to something that matters to you and me when we're sick is patchy. For example, Chalmers points out that it's now more than 10 years since the gene for cystic fibrosis was discovered, but patients are yet to see a clinical benefit of that discovery. He argues there are higher priorities, most importantly doing clinical trials to test whether treatments work. In Australia, the National Health and Medical Research Council awarded $490 million of research funding in 2005, of which $36 million, less than 10%, was for studies that included clinical trials. Worse, even in clinical trials, Chalmers argues money is being wasted on trials that do not address questions that matter to patients.
Too many trials which are addressing utterly trivial issues, issues that are of not prime importance to patients and the people trying to look after them, are done. In fact, I would be very glad if patients became more critical and discerning about which trials they were prepared to participate in. Take the example of steroids given in acute traumatic brain injury. That's an issue which is of no interest to industry and only of minor interest to most neuroscientists and people involved in academia. So had it not been for our Medical Research Council deciding that this was an important unanswered question that needed to be addressed, it wouldn't have got addressed. We need to do more trials that are relevant to the needs of patients and clinicians. If I can give you an example from a study done in Bristol, it concerned osteoarthritis of the knee. They asked the question, what are the research priorities from the position of patients themselves, rheumatologists, physiotherapists, general practitioners, and health service managers?
Rheumatologists specialise in looking after joint conditions.
Exactly. They had focus groups of these different people. What they came up with was that none of these people wanted any more drug trials. What they wanted was better evaluation of physiotherapy, better evaluation of surgery, and better evaluation of interventions to help people cope with this chronic disabling painful condition. Yet, when they looked at what research was actually being done, most of the research being done was on drugs. So there was an almost complete mismatch. There's also a mismatch in terms of the outcome measures. One example where people with rheumatoid arthritis this time were asked which symptoms they found most troubling, and that was fatigue. It was a more important symptom for more patients than pain, and it came as a complete surprise. In other words, research has not been directed to finding out how you actually reduce the fatigue that's associated with rheumatoid arthritis. One of the reasons for that is that, left to themselves, researchers didn't even know it was important.
Sir Ian Chalmers. So there are lots of problems with getting good quality evidence. As I mentioned before, just as important, though, is the problem of doctors not using that evidence even when it is available. Evidence-based medicine is a system of practice that places most reliance on evidence from trials and relatively little weight on evidence from less rigorous studies or on biological predictions. It's now nearly 15 years since evidence-based medicine was first described in mainstream medical journals, but less than 10 years since universities started teaching it to students. That means most doctors in practice today were trained before the discoveries outlined in this program were made. And that means most healthcare providers are not familiar with evidence-based practice and do not discuss evidence from trials, or the lack of it, with their patients. Here's another example to illustrate the problem. I need to declare a conflict of interest because the speaker you're about to hear is my brother. By the way, he's not a doctor. What you're about to hear happened one evening last summer when Ross took his daughter Olivia, then aged 10 months, to the emergency department at their local hospital. Olivia was unwell with a high fever.
Pretty quickly they seemed to think it was probably a urinary tract infection and put her on a drip and gave her IV antibiotics. And then it was just kind of a night of trying to settle her. In the morning, a specialist came in and immediately said, right, this is what we're going to do. We're going to go through these series of tests and there might need to be surgery.
Did she say what sort of tests?
The thing I primarily remember is that test is something that was going to be very upsetting to Olivia and it was quite invasive. At about that point, I said, do we really need to do this? And she said, yes, we absolutely need to do it. And I said, why do we need to do it? What's the evidence to suggest that's a good thing? Pretty much as soon as I said that, she said, I don't like your attitude. Why are you being so aggressive? And I said, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to be aggressive. I'm just trying to figure out what's best for my little girl. The reply came back, well, this is what we do because it's best practice. And I said, maybe it is, but is there any evidence to support? And she said, well, we don't necessarily always use the evidence. We use what is best practice. And I said, okay, why is it considered to be best practice? She said, because that's what we do. And eventually she said, maybe you should seek a second opinion.
Did you go ahead and get the second opinion?
We did. Somebody who'd actually been suggested as a paediatrician who was very interested in evidence-based medicine and who was also doing a study on urinary tract infection. The second opinion was that there was no evidence that the intervention was beneficial.
What was the trial that he was running, the second doctor?
The trial was to say, if we put that child on a long-term low dose of antibiotics, does it decrease the chance of a second urinary tract infection? One of the suggestions of the initial doctor was that immediately she goes on a long-term course of antibiotics, 6-12 months or longer, which was something that I didn't feel particularly comfortable about, as again, there was no evidence to support that. The position I came to was, if Olivia got a second infection, then we would join the trial. That was 8 or 10 months ago now, and there's been no further urinary tract infections, and she seems quite happy and fine.
So how do you feel at the end of all of this?
The process through emergency and the care from the staff on the ward was great. The specialist approach was, I guess, unnecessarily intrusive, and for no apparently good reason other than this is just the way we've always done it. I was quite happy to stand there and say, well, that's not a good enough reason. If there's not a proven good reason for doing it, you want to kind of consider very, very carefully why you're doing it.
Ross's struggle to get evidence-based care is not an isolated one. Consumer representative Karen Carey-Hazel is a member of the Consumers Health Forum, the peak national body that provides consumer input into health policy.
We do know a lot about evidence. We know what should be done, but what isn't happening is that that evidence is being implemented into practice. There's no changed clinical practice. I've been sitting on committees for at least 7 or 8 years where we know the evidence, we need to get it out on the ground, but the bottom line is that clinical practice doesn't change, and it's been quite disconcerting, really. What I would like to see is that all practice is based on evidence. I can't imagine any justification for practice being based on anything but evidence. And I guess that from the consumer perspective, where we are going is that rather than having spent the last 10 years saying to doctors, please, please, please use the evidence, we're really looking at moving the pressure for evidence-based practice from the supply side and onto the demand side.
Karen Carey-Hazel, former chair of the Health Consumers Council of Western Australia. In other words, she's suggesting it's time that all of us get more active about demanding that doctors use the best evidence. So far, I've raised a lot of questions, and you might be feeling a little concerned about going to see a doctor at all. Don't forget, there have been major advances in healthcare and in life expectancy in the last century. We're a lot better off than people in the 19th century and before, when healthcare was all opinion and belief and no science. In the 20th century, there have been amazing advances in biology and medical science. But perhaps we've become too dazzled by the promises now made. Yes, we've got the power to unlock the mysteries of human bodies, but there's also the possibility of wandering off down many fascinating dead ends. We need to spend more time and effort working out what the unanswered questions are that really matter to you and me when we see our healthcare providers, and make sure that studies to address them get done. And then we need to make sure that evidence gets used when we decide which treatment to have. In next week's program, we'll look at how that might be done. We'll look at ways to encourage doctors and other health professionals to use evidence about treatments, and how to communicate about that with you and me, so we increase our chances of getting therapy that works and decrease our chances of getting therapies that are useless or dangerous.
That was part one of Facing the Evidence, a two-part series on how to get our health professionals to practice according to the evidence. Alex Barrett is Associate Professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Sydney. Next week, find out why it's up to you and me to get change in the system. This has been The Health Report. And I'm Norman Swan.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.